Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Everyone, this is Klaatu, and you're listening to Chronicles and Commons, and in this episode I want to talk about the flora and fauna of Barsoom from the Edgar Rice Burroughs John Carter series. We've talked about most of all the races on Barsoom. Now, I'm going to give you a little hint here. There's actually one that I haven't covered yet, or technically two. I don't want to get into it, though, because I want that to be kind of a focus of its own episode, because I think that it's just that good, and you'll hopefully, ideally, you'll find out why I'm saying that. Well, eventually for yourself, but certainly when I do the episode, you'll see what I mean. So and to reiterate, there are so many Barsoom novels, and I'm doing a subset of them because I'm only doing the public domain books. Now, I do want to reiterate as well, because I haven't really mentioned it lately, that there's already an RPG out there that is based on the John Carter series, and it's probably worth looking at if you are really, really into John Carter of Mars. It is by a company called Modiphius. There are two drawbacks, I guess, of Modiphius doing this game. One is that their game, the game itself is not open game license. Whether that actually matters to you or not is going to depend on whether you want to sort of build upon what they've built. And then the other maybe drawback is that they use a system called the 2D20 system, which I've never played actually, but it's, you know, certainly it's something that you would have to learn if you're used to, you know, a D20 system or a dice pool system or a fate system or whatever. So that may or may not be a drawback. However, it's probably worth considering looking into the game based on the information that they would have in their books. But again, I can't guarantee which parts of the information they have, because I've never looked at it. I don't know which parts that they have are, you know, based on public domain information versus what they've made up. So it might be difficult to sort of extricate one from the other. I'm not sure. So I'm covering books that are public domain. So the topics that I'm covering are ripe for iteration and for inclusion in your own fiction or game works or whatever. I might be leaving some things out. I'm not intentionally doing that, but there are a couple of things that are mentioned offhand, and then he either forgets to get back to them later, or he does, but I've forgotten at that point to take note of it. Who knows? Because I feel like in my head I took note of it. So really, the main thing here are the beasts of Barsoom, and we may as well start out with the classic one. It's the worst sort of the worst abomination, apparently, turn-of-the-century authors could think of, seemed to be pretty consistently, because I've read this in Edgar Rice Burroughs, I've read it in Lovecraft, and I feel like I've read it elsewhere, but pretty consistently it seems like a white ape is just to turn-of-the-century science fiction authors one of the worst things you could imagine. It is one of those things that I keep coming across, and I just don't get it. In the depths of my soul, I just don't understand why. Honestly, I don't understand why an ape is all that terrifying. And that's incorrect. I know that. Like if I went to a zoo and I climbed into the cage of containing a gorilla, I understand that I would be in danger, and I would probably truly feel the horror of how terrifying an ape could be. So I get that. Funny story, I was at what they call an ANP show here in New Zealand. It's a livestock show where people sort of take prizes for the biggest cow or the biggest sheep or what, you know, like weird stuff like that. Stuff that I'm completely not used to. But I saw part of the competition for the cow. And I saw how these cows were just pushing the people who were leading them out, to show the cow off. There was just so much force behind these cattle. And this isn't, understand, this isn't like a rodeo or anything, like where people are abusing the animals or jumping on their backs and making them buck or anything like that. This was purely like a livestock, sort of like a county fair type thing where you show the animal, and I don't know, the one that looks best by some collection of rules wins the blue ribbon prize. Actually, it was a red ribbon, I think, for first, blue for second, something like that. But point is, I knew that, cattle, cows, whatever, were big, and I knew that they were legendarily pretty hefty. They, you'd see them drawing carts in old movies and stuff, but I never really kind of saw it for myself. And I saw this pretty big dude, like a big farmer, leading his cow out onto the into the field to show the judges, and the cow didn't want to do it, and was just being stubborn, and would just kind of like resist, or would sort of push or something, and you could just see the person like being physically just displaced, and it was pretty terrific. So yeah, some of these animals with all that muscle, they can be terrifying, and for some reason the white ape was considered pretty terrifying. Now, these white apes, to be fair, are colossal. They are colossal ape-like creatures. They are white, and hairless, except for an enormous shock of bristly hair upon its head. They mate for life, as far as we can tell, or at least they take mates. Maybe it's not for life, but they definitely hang out with their mate for a while. They do look pretty much like Earth apes from what the description itself says. They are about 10 or 15 feet tall, depending on whether you're talking about the male or the female of the species. And they have four arms. That's significant to understand. They have four arms, and then their two legs, and then they have, I think they have four arms. I don't actually see note of that here now. And I'm not 100% sure whether I just saw like a picture on the internet interpretation, maybe on that RPG box set, actually. I'm not sure. If I recall, they have four arms like the Green Martians do, and then they are capable of using tools of rudimentary tools. So for instance, when John Carter has a very close encounter with one in, I think, book three, one of them swings a cudgel at him. So he's got a nice big club that he's swinging around. I got the distinct impression that they were meant to be maybe borderline intelligent. They were like just intelligent enough to be dangerous. They mated for extended periods of time. They used tools. They kind of, I think they kind of made a little, not a house, but they camped out in a place and it seemed like home. And when John sort of stumbled into their domain, that's when they started trying to kill him. So it was pretty fair, really, honestly. But of course, in turn of the century books, it's never fair to be threatened by an animal, even if you're barging in on the animal's domain. So the white apes are mentioned several times throughout the books, actually. They live near the or within the valley of Issus, so they're a great reason to sort of stay away from Iss, and not only because they because Iss contains it is the homeland of a fearsome cult, but also because if you're not being chased by the cult members, then you're being hunted by white apes and plant men. I might as well talk about plant men next, I guess. So the plant men live also in the mysterious Iss, toward the Silean-infested waters of the Lost Sea of Chorus. So that's where the white apes also hang out sometimes. White apes apparently go farther north though, because they're encountered. They seem to be encountered in several areas, but certainly they're infamous for hanging out with the plant men. Not necessarily. I didn't get the sense that they were friends with the plant men. It's just that the two dangers were the plant men and the white apes in this lost sea of Korus. The plant men are they are human-like creatures, except they are made of plants. They have snake-like hair upon their heads, which sort of almost serve as antenna. It's almost as if though that their hair, as it were sentient in itself. It would, you know, almost it would kind of move around as if looking or smelling for clues of what's out there. These plant men are from the original tree of life that spawned all life on Barsoom. So technically, arguably, the plant men are actually the original living creatures of Barsoom. They are pretty warlike, or at least I should say they're quite defensive of their territory. There's no indication that the plant men fight one another, but they do seem to be pretty antagonistic. I mean, certainly they're feared within the Lost Sea of Korus, or around the Lost Sea of Korus. They are antagonistic to some of the larger settlements as well. They outright attack one of the settlements in the third book, The Gods of Mars. They are charging one of the city walls, and they have a unique fighting style. They do a sort of a mad rush at their enemies, and then they jump, they leap into the air bizarrely. That's not what you might expect of plant men. I think a lot of us in sort of our very strict kind of modern design sensibilities would think, okay, well, plant men are going to burrow underground suddenly. Like right when they reach you, they'll burrow underground and they'll pop right back up behind you and clobber you over the head or something like that. But that's not what they do. Instead, they jump into the air over your head, and right as they're over you, they swing down and crack your skull, like, quote, as though it had been an eggshell. And that's what they do. And plant men are pretty, even though they are plant men, they are essentially they're a beast. They're a monster. We don't meet, at least within the public domain books, as far as I'm aware, we don't meet plant men. We don't converse with them. We don't get a sense for any kind of advanced culture or anything like that. They are, as far as I can tell, they are purely, they're just evil, mean, scary creatures that try to kill things that they encounter, usually without any kind of real reason. Okay, so next there's the Banth. That's B-A-N-T-H. So not a Bantha, B-A-N-T-H-A, just a Banth, Banth. The Banths are lions. That's basically what they are. They are, they have tiny ears on their head. They're the big, scary mouth full of sharp and powerful fangs, and 10 legs. So 5 on each side. 10 legs. They sort of creep along the ground, ready to paralyze their prey, and that's what they seem to be. They're stalkers. They follow things out in the wilderness. They'll creep behind it, and then of course other creatures will follow the Banth in just like in real life. Smaller creatures will follow, you know, the lion or something, hoping to sort of capitalize on either the unused portion of their prey, or they hope that the Banth might stalk the prey into relative exhaustion and then give up and leave, leaving some other creature to then actually close in for the kill. They don't seem to be tree climbers, as far as I can tell. In fact, one character who we'll get into in a later episode climbs up a tree to get away from a Banth, and it does not attempt to pursue into the tree. It does lurk around the bottom of the tree in hopes of this character coming out of the tree, and then being able to move in for the kill. But it does not pursue into the tree. So it doesn't seem to be a tree dwelling cat at all. I mean, not that lions are. I'm just explaining to you that well, most lions aren't. I'm just saying that, yeah, there's they do seem to be pretty fond of the land. They creep around. I generally get the sense that they are very they serve sort of the niche in the ecosystem as the same as the lion. It's kind of the king of the jungle as far as I can tell. It seems to be pretty fearsome. It has a hideous roar that awakens the hills themselves. It echoes through the whole valley and things respond, or they chirp back to, you know, to warn the bands not to come over there and so on. So it has an impact on the local ecosystem. I don't know that they necessarily hang out in packs, but then again, I got the sense that where one banth was, there were probably several others. So I couldn't tell whether that was sort of an expectation, like this is a pack of banths, or whether it's just this is an area where there happen to be banths around, and so we should be careful. So I'm not too sure about sort of their social structure, but they're a big, dumb hunting animal. And dumb, I just mean they're not they don't have they don't talk and they don't think, but I mean, or they think, but they don't have a very high intelligence. They're just an animal, in other words. Okay, so next is a callot. A callot is, I think, I want to say it's the first. I believe it might be the first, might be the second actually. As the more I say it, the more I think it might be the second beast that we encounter on Barsoom. Either way, one of the early ones. It appears in the first book and continues through several of them. The famous one is Woola, Woola, I believe is his name, and this is it's really the hound dog that is given to John Carter in the first book and accompanies him as his dog, really. I mean, it serves the same purpose as a guard dog or a hound dog on Earth, except it's a callot. It's not at all like a dog in terms of its appearance, but it behaves more or less like a dog. So I'll just read a little bit out of John Carter when we first encounter this callot. Sola motioned me to be seated upon a pile of silks near the center of the room, and, turning, made a peculiar hissing sound, as though signaling to someone in an adjoining room. In response to her call, I obtained my first sight of a new Martian wonder. It waddled in on its 10 short legs and squatted down before the girl like an obedient puppy. The thing was about the size of a Shetland pony, but its head bore a slight resemblance to that of a frog, except that the jaws were equipped with 3 rows of long, sharp tusks. And that's our introduction to Woola. From then on, he is constantly described as either a dog or a puppy or some such thing. John Carter even likens him to his own dog on Earth, back on Earth. So he is very much, the callot is very much a dog, and you'll encounter callot being used more or less as an insult to, you know, to suggest that someone is a callot is to suggest that they're a dog. You know, you are a filthy dog, or a cur. Instead of that, you say you're a callot on Barsoom. Next up is the Zitidar. 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 The Zitidar. I always want to say Zititar, but it's Zitidar. The Zitidar is a big animal. It's a big mastodon type animal. Heavy draft animals. They pull carts and carry hefty loads. That's what they are. That's what they do. Because the banth sounds so much like a bantha, I basically default to the banth, remember, is the lion. A bantha is the thing in Star Wars that the sand people ride. So the Zitidar, to me, is a Star Wars bantha. I mean, let's face it, there's a lot in Star Wars that kind of harkens back to John Carter, and I don't have the evidence to demonstrate that George Lucas was influenced by John Carter, but I know that he was influenced by old sci-fi. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket science to figure that out, but I'm pretty sure that's on record. And so it's So it's no surprise that some of the terms from John Carter, if not directly like similar, you could, I mean, Jed and Jedi, Banth, Bantha, there are a couple of similarities that I keep noting here and there, but if not directly similar, then there's a certain linguistic sort of tradition is carried on, I think, in Star Wars. So whether the Zitidars look more like a Bantha or more just like an elephant, I cannot say. They are supposed to be big and hefty. They are draft animals. They pull things. They lug things around. That's what they do. And that's all they do. Let's see. Another animal, and this might be the first one that we encounter on Barsoom, is the Thoat. The Thoat is, well, it's a little bit, it's a horse, first of all. That's if you want the easy equi thing to equate it to, it's a horse. It has eight legs, so it's a little bit different in that sense than a horse, but it is a horse. Its head splits almost in two by its mouth. It's got a big, broad mouth. It also has a big, broad tail, almost like a beaver's tail, almost. It's used essentially as beasts. Well, no, I was going to say beasts of burden, but that's more, I think, of the Zitidar. So it's used more like, well, a horse, a war horse, or a mode of transportation by both the Green Martians and the Red Martians. There are small thoats, which the Red Martians ride, and then there are larger ones for the Green Martians. I imagine that's just a question of breeding, just optimizing your breed. Because I went to this this livestock show 2 weeks ago, I feel like I can talk about breeding and things like that as if though I'm an expert, because I've been to a show where there were animals, so obviously I know what I'm talking about. So yeah, the Thoats, they're kind of a staple animal. I kind of get the feeling that they're one of the early companion animals for the Barsoomians. I don't know that I can back that up, but it's little hints, like they have thoat oil for, I think, lamps or something to burn in lamps and things like that. So you kind of get that sense that it was one of those animals that were utilitarian from a very early stage in development. Although, I mean, by the time we get to Barsoom, we're so far near supposedly the end of the world that it's almost silly to even speculate, but nevertheless, that's what I'm doing. I'm saying I think that the Thoats were probably very early on designated as like utilitarian animals, and if they're alive, then it's great because they can work. If they can no longer work, then we're going to kill them, and we're going to use every single bit of them for keeping things going, whether it's oil in our lamps or maybe the hide for clothes and whatever else you do with horse parts or thoat parts. So that's a thoat. You'll hear about thoats all throughout the books. It's one of the essentials. It's just a thing, the thoat. It's a thoat, it's a thoat, it's a thoat. They don't really use vehicles on the ground all that much, honestly, that I can think of at all. They really defer to thoats, and I like that about this sci-fi world. And I know that this was probably heavily influenced by simply what Edgar Rice Burroughs was seeing in the modern time, and then, maybe as far as any of us can look sort of into the future based on what's going on around us. But as a sci-fi thing, I just love that there's that sort of, it's almost an advanced civilization in a way, where they kind of acknowledge that it just makes more sense to ride the thoats around on the ground rather than go to the trouble of developing all this technology for ground transport. When we've got something perfectly serviceable right here, we'll do with thoats and zitidars. And then for air travel, now, okay, well, we don't apparently have any kind of winged animal that we can harness, so we shall instead develop airships and so on. So I really like that sort of that mixed culture of this ancient, or of this, yeah, I mean, ancient in the sense that it's been around for such a long time, this ancient culture that's near the end of its life, right? The Martian world is dying, and yet, like, either the way that they're dealing with that or the way they've simply developed has been to use the natural resources around them and then develop technology for the things that for whatever reason, the natural resources aren't providing. There are a couple more animals I should cover, get this, the Sith, S-I-T-H. These are huge hornets. Imagine, if you can, a bald-faced hornet of your earthly experience grown to the size of a prize Hereford bull, and you will have some faint conception of the ferocious appearance and awesome formidability of the winged monster that bore down upon me. Frightful jaws in front and mighty poisoned sting behind made my relatively puny longsword seem a pitiful weapon of defense indeed, nor could I hope to escape the lightning-like movements or hide from those myriad facet eyes which covered three-fourths of the hideous head, permitting the creature to see in all directions at one and the same time. So, this is the Sith, and that is S-I-T-H. I just want to emphasize what I was saying earlier about maybe this possibly being an influence on latter-day sci-fi. And it is, it's a big hornet, the size of a bull. This hangs out sort of in that jungle swamp area and tries its best to kill John Carter and his trusty hound. I think the final animal life I have written down here is apt, A-P-T. These are beasts of the frozen north. You could call them an abominable snowman, I guess, for lack of a better idea. They're huge, white-furred creatures with six limbs, four of which, short and heavy, carry it swiftly over the snow and ice, while the other two, growing forward from its shoulders on either side of its long, powerful neck, terminate in white, hairless hands, with which it seizes and holds its prey. Its head and mouth are more similar in appearance to those of a hippopotamus than to any other earthly animal, except that from the sides of the lower jawbone, two mighty horns curve slightly downward toward the front. Its two huge eyes inspired my greatest curiosity. They extend in two vast oval patches from the center of the top of the cranium, down either side of the head to below the roots of the horns, so that these weapons really grow out from the lower part of the eyes, which are composed of several thousand ocelli each. This eye structure seemed remarkable in a beast whose haunts were upon a glaring field of ice and snow, and though I found upon minute examination of several that we killed that each ocellus is furnished with its own lid, and that the animal can at will close as many of the facets as his huge eye as he chooses, yet I was positive that nature had thus equipped him because much of his life was to be spent in dark, subterranean recesses. So that's those are the apts. I think they tend to stand about 8 feet tall, I think, when they're actually standing on their hind legs, but it sounds like they don't necessarily do that often. And they are certainly an interesting sounding beast. I think some of the anatomy of the apt probably makes up for the sort of stock, sort of the sort of plain ape, but let's make it white instead of black or orange, that kind of thing. This is truly unique, I think, and that's pretty cool. They're absolutely ferocious. I have to say that in many cases he talks up the animals more than we actually see the ferocity of them, and that's maybe a little bit disappointing. But in terms of pitting it against your own fictional character, whether in a story or in a game, this thing is apparently in essentially an eternal rage, a perpetual bestial rage is what is how it is described. It says, he stood head on eyeing us as we approached him, for we had found it a waste of time to attempt to escape the perpetual bestial rage which seems to possess these demon creatures who rove the dismal north, attacking every living thing that comes within the scope of their far-seeing eyes. So yeah, it's a pretty ferocious creature, and as you may have caught on from previous episodes, I'm kind of a sucker for the ice escapes and the frozen landscapes and the frozen cultures, and so this is very much this appeals to me a lot. Why it is in the ice, I don't know. Like I don't have a super clear idea of why this creature chooses to hang out in the frozen wastelands of the north. I don't know why it hasn't migrated away from that, but it does sound like it actually hangs out underground, and that kind of goes, you know, that sort of speaks of that underworld of the Lovecraft realm. So I don't know, maybe there's some kind of mixture between the frozen north and the underground, sort of the underdark of the Forgotten Realms kind of style of society going on here. Who knows? But it's a pretty cool beast to try to fight. So let's talk a little bit about the ecology of Barsoom. We don't have a whole lot of description of how of kind of the landscapes of Barsoom. And I feel like in a weird way that's one of the things that's really, really missing from the books because of course in most modern minds Barsoom is just a red desert. I mean, we've literally seen pictures now. So it's hard to kind of separate what Edgar Rice Burroughs was thinking when he was writing these versus what we know to be there right now, especially since he does also emphasize that Mars is a dying planet at the time of the book. So at the time of the stories. So it's difficult to kind of separate red barren desert world from what might have been seen in his mind's eye, and he doesn't help us along all that much. He doesn't really give us many descriptions of what we're anticipating or of what we should be picturing in our head. One ecosystem that we are privy to is the north. The very, very high north is just like our own. It's an Arctic wasteland. It's got lots of snow, and yet some creatures, the yellow Martians, live up there in the snow, and they're quite happy there, and they're quite isolated because they're surrounded by an Arctic wasteland. So we get a little bit of a sense for that. Similarly, we get a description of a land known as Kaol, Kaol, and that seems to be a little bit of a forest or a jungle. And I will read a small description because this is one of the richer descriptions that he provides, actually. Slender purple grasses topped with red and yellow fern-like fronds grew rankly all about us to the height of several feet above my head. Myriad creepers hung festooned in graceful loops from tree to tree, and among them were several varieties of the Martian manflower, whose blooms have eyes and hands with which to see and seize the insects which form their diet. The repulsive callot tree, too, was much in evidence. It is a carnivorous plant of about the bigness of a large sagebrush, such as dots our western plains. Each branch ends in a set of strong jaws, which have been known to drag down and devour large and formidable beasts of prey. Both Woola and I had several narrow escapes from these greedy, arborous monsters. Occasional areas of firm sod gave us intervals of rest from the arduous labor of traversing this gorgeous twilight swamp, and it was upon one of these that I finally decided to make camp for the night, which my chronometer warned me would soon be upon us. Many varieties of fruit grew in abundance about us, and as Martian callots were omnivorous, Woola had no difficulty in making a square meal after I had brought down the viands for him. Then, having eaten two, I lay down with my back to that of my faithful hound, and dropped into a deep and dreamless sleep. The forest was shrouded in impenetrable darkness when a low growl from Woola awakened me. All about us I could hear the stealthy movement of great padded feet, and now and then the wicked gleam of green eyes upon us. Arising, I drew my long sword and waited. It's a great passage. And it describes it. I mean, this is, like I say, this is some of the richest descriptions he provides, honestly, throughout the whole books. And this is in Warlords of Mars. Oh, that's the third book, isn't it? Warlords. Second one is Gods. First one is Princess. Slender purple grasses. It's beautiful. Red and yellow fern-like fronds. It's nice. But the things that we're really kind of looking at here are the Martian manflower, a plant with eyes and hands that catch insects. It's unclear whether that is literally a plant man or whether that's just a completely different thing. I believe it's a different thing because not long after this segment, he actually does encounter plant men and they're attacking a city. So I don't know why they would just be hanging out in the swamp jungle, letting John Carter pass by. I feel like that would be a much more exciting fight. So I think they're just plants. There's also the callot tree, which bizarrely has the same name as the the Kalets, the Wula, Wula the Kalet, is you hear John Carter describe him as a hound. But then also there's a Kalet tree, which is an omnivore, is a carnivorous plant of about the bigness and largeness of a sagebrush, and it has strong jaws and tries to eat things. So it's kind of confusing. You get essentially a man flower, which is kind of like saying a plant man, and a Kalet tree, which is literally already the name of the hound. It is a little bit difficult. It's maybe like Edgar Rice Burroughs just couldn't think of good plants and just thought, well, one could be like a man with eyes and hands, and the other could be like a dog with a big, powerful jaw, forgetting sort of that he was also describing a man and a dog going through the forest. So I feel like that's just a little bit confusing, but if you read it carefully and look at the intent, it does seem like they're both innocently, just circumstantially, plants that remind us of a human and a dog, or a dog-like reptile called a Kalet, and there's no, it's just coincidence that those two things are also other things. And that's fine. That's fine. But then that's sort of the plant life as such as we know on Barsoom. I mean, there are hints here and there of other forms of both beast and plant, but those are the ones that stood out the most. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.